Hello all, and welcome to It Had to Be Said. This is going to be a little bit of a different format, and quite honestly, I'm not sure how long it will be. But I wanted to create a specific pod talking about what happened March 3rd, or yesterday on the date of this release, involving further attacks on a U.S. contractor and just U.S. interests in Iraq. The previous release of the pod talked about this in a rant regarding an attack that had happened earlier in which President Joe Biden had retaliated for. So in that rant, I did learn through some research about a little bit about who this group was that had attacked the U.S. And went into some history. But I do think that this is somewhat becoming more and more of a dire situation. And so I wanted to do something of a deep dive. It's not going to be a lecture or anything, but I did want to go into a bit more of the history of this. And really, the goal is, of course, to be informed in general, but also just to see how incorrect the U.S. media is in terms of their description of these events. Hopefully challenge some preconceived notions that people have. I've noticed in discussing this with people, especially people in the U.S. on social media, and then, of course, in person, that we have very short timelines, and we tend to compartmentalize things, where in reality, this is much, much more of an ecosystem type situation where there's a lot of things that touch on a lot of different pieces of recent and older history. So in short, I think that the American point of view on what's happened recently is just incorrect. And we can get into some of the complexities of it and you know, how the U.S. is even connecting Iran to any of this, because Iran is definitely a part of it. But at the top, it isn't as if this is like a U.S. versus Iran thing. And that's unfortunately what I think the U.S. is attempting to shape this as the drums are getting carried out to begin that drumbeat. Potentially towards war. I would say a new war, but this is forever war. We've been there for 20 years. As I like to point out often, this is the Revolutionary War plus the Civil War plus World War II combined. So if that's not surprising or shocking to you, I kind of don't know what to say. So President Biden ordered airstrikes on February 25th of 2021 this year. And he called this a retaliatory thing. It's in retaliation over a rocket attack that killed a U.S. contractor. This happened in a Kurdish region of Iraq. It's a commercial airbase, but it's well known that U.S. military have a presence on that airbase. And since then, another rocket attack has occurred. This one being the one that was discussed before on March 3rd. And this has killed another contractor. Rhetoric from the administration frames this as, again, a U.S.-Iranian battle with Iran backing the groups responsible. As of now, and I haven't looked this morning, but the State Department or no one from the military or the Biden administration has said what group is responsible for this, but I think it's fair to say it's the group or an affiliated group that was also coordinating with the February 25th attack. So I found this quote from Yahoo News story. The president's decision appeared aimed at sending a signal to Iran and its proxies in the region that Washington would not tolerate attacks on its personnel in Iraq. And I pointed this out in the previous podcast, but you know, the whole idea of framing it as retaliation is just problematic, because let's not forget that we're the occupiers And so the people who are attacking us, they are the ones that are viewing this as retaliation. And so, I mean, you know, it's either juvenile or it's just incorrect for the U.S. to say that, you know, because either we're saying we're retaliating against you for retaliating against us, or we're saying that your initial act of retaliation is not legitimate, but ours is, even though we're the occupying force. And, you know, both of those are just deeply problematic views on the situation. And this is how most Democrats are portraying events, you know, elected officials, but also just people on social media, Twitter in particular. I've run into, and I talked about this in the previous pod, I've just run into a lot of disheartening comments. And I think the most disheartening was one person, self-identified liberal Democrat, that said, and I'm paraphrasing, that we just need troops sometimes. It is what it is. and that's, it's not, that's not what it is, especially when it doesn't affect you. But anyway, the group that took responsibility for the February attack is called Guardians of Blood Brigade. And, you know, I went into this a little bit in the previous pod too, so I won't hear, but who knows if this is something that will last for a long time, or if it's just a front group, if it's, you know, something that is just a breakaway, a mutation from another militia. I likened it to what happened in Northern Ireland in the late 90s, when especially the unionists, the Ulster unionist terrorist groups, started branching off into all these little subgroups to kind of make it more confusing to know, you know, who was doing what. But in a quote from the Guardian of Blood Brigade's leaders, they described the February attack as this: "We approached the base of the occupation at a distance of 7 kilometers. And we were able to direct a devastating strike of 24 rockets, which hit their targets accurately after the CRAM system and the occupier shells failed to intercept them." And so this is important because I want to dissect some of the language being used here. Twice in that short paragraph, the term occupier was being used. And this is very important because not only does this give you insight into how these groups view the U.S., I think that it is also a point of agreement in an odd way, in which talking to people, again, social media, Twitter, in real life in the U.S., it's acknowledged that, I mean, we are occupying the region. And this group that we're calling a terrorist organization or a proxy group of Iran, and that gets extremely complicated. But this group, you know, that we're calling a terrorist organization is basically saying, yes, we attacked you because you're an occupying force. And the U.S. is saying, yes, we are an occupying force, and we're retaliating against your attack. And so just, you know, how does that jive? I don't want to go off on that further. I talked about that a little bit in the last pod. But you know, I hope, just please challenge your preconceived views of this. So the Guardians of Blood Brigade does appear to be a Shiite group. And without going into a theological history of Islam, there are two main factions, kind of like Protestant and Catholic and Christianity. And of course, there's a many, many more subsects. And you know, that's kind of true with Islam. But the two big ones are Shiite and Sunni. And I think what we're going to see in what I feel like I found when looking at this is that ultimately more than nationality, although religion is tied to nationality in this region and nationalism, that this is really what it comes down to. It's almost a misnomer to say something like Iran and Saudi Arabia, but in other ways it's not, again, because these are, you know, semi or full theocracies. But regardless, the Guardian of Blood Brigade does appear to be a Shiite group, and will be called correctly or not by the U.S. a proxy of Iran. Iran is a Shiite dominant country. However, we don't know whether or not this group is tied to Iran per se. We don't know how closely they are, if there are ties. We don't know what capacity they are. We don't know any of this. So it's very easy to say a proxy of Iran, but that can mean it's a direct link, or it could mean really that it's a Shiite group that gets some funding from the Iranian government, which is a Shiite dominant country. And this is where it gets murky and complicated. And, you know, this is really where, to be honest, even talking about Sunni and Shiite for most people in the U.S. is kind of, you know, beyond the first level discussion of the Middle East. But getting down to this level of, you know, of what that even means, or what does a proxy of Iran even mean in this situation, gets extremely murky and complicated. And to go a little bit further with this, Mahmoud Mohammed, a member of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, said that the attackers were, in quotes, a lawless group on the side of PMF and with its capacity and uniform. And so here's where the murkiness comes in, because it feels like the U.S., or at least the media, would like us to think of people in Iran, you know, in Tehran, sitting around and saying, okay, so, you know, what are we going to do to attack the U.S. because we hate the U.S., because they're the bad guys. And so they're going to outfit a bunch of militias to go and try to attack, you know, U.S. servicemen or contractors in the region. And that, you know, we're not going to stand for that. We're going to retaliate against that. Well, you know, yes and no. So this Mahmoud Mohammed points to PMF as one of the probably where this group came from or originated from. And I haven't heard the Biden administration, you know, use this acronym or the full name. I haven't seen it in the news. The last time I've seen, when I look for articles, they're all a few years old, but PMF stands for Popular Mobilization Forces. So if you don't know what popular mobilization forces are, and we're talking about bombing people in Syria or Iran over attacks on contractors, we need to do some background, because this is the beginning point of what we really need to know. The PMF was established by Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in 2014 to aid Iraqi security forces in fighting ISIL, or ISIS, and we'll just call it ISIL here. We remember ISIL, of course. They were the bad guys before. I don't know, is China? China is the bad guy now, I guess, or maybe it's Iran. I guess if you're Republican, it's China. If you're a Democrat, it's Iran. I don't know. But at one point, ISIL were the bad guys, and they truly were bad. What many people don't know about ISIL is that ISIL wasn't new. So the PMF was established by a prime minister in Iraq to help Iraqi security forces fight against ISIL. And that's where this organization, Guardians of Blood Brigade, appears to come from, according to Mahmoud Mohammed, someone actually in the region that understands the culture, history, language, etc., instead of someone from the State Department saying a proxy of Iran. Now, both things can be true, so we'll say that. But it's, again, one is misleading for political reasons. So getting back to ISIL here, or ISIS, as we'll call it ISIL now. You know, ISIL was not a new thing. It broke on the scene in the U.S. and the media as a new thing. It was all over Vice News articles and stuff, and it became, you know, there's bumper stickers and stuff from right-wing people, but it was in the region for a while. And getting back to Sunni and Shia, it was really a Sunni-based jihad movement. And it had existed previous to the name ISIL. It just recreated into that. And it recreated into that after the 2007 U.S. military surge, which had defeated the previous iteration of it. But before we get into that, I do think it's worth kind of looking at again, when we talk about the region, yes, you can almost, we'll say it like this, talk about Sunni Shia in terms of nations. You can almost swap them out, right? So you can talk about Iran and talk about Shia, for instance, and in many ways they're connected. So you could be a Shia militia and receive funding from Tehran, but not be in any way connected to, you know, the military or even the politics of Iran for that matter. And this brings up an interesting point. In debriefing the president, the interrogation of Saddam Hussein by John Nixon, Saddam Hussein said this, and this is quotes, the U.S., you are going to fail in Iraq because you do not know the language, the history, and you do not understand the Arab mind. And a common theme in these observations is Muslim sectarianism. Saddam himself was a Sunni, and he seemed baffled, according to this interrogation, for why the U.S. opposed his regime, as it was largely a secular regime focusing on politics, not religion, and that he held Shia terrorist groups, or what the State Department today would call, you know, Iranian proxy groups in many situations. He kept them in check in the region. And so in this interrogation, it was interesting to read, you know, he didn't really understand what the problem was with the U.S. In terms of him. But getting back to ISIL, and I guess the reason why I bring that up is this quote, basically saying you're going to fail because, in other words, you don't understand what you're doing here. You don't understand the region. You don't understand what's happening. And I think getting back to that Sunni Shiite sectarianism is the core of it, and it's also the thing that we don't understand. I think, you know, if that's number one, then a much, much, much smaller number two would also be a history of colonialism. But getting back to ISIL, before it was called ISIL, it was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So ISIL had been around for a long time. And I think that this is important to know too, because I think in Western perceptions, it's seen as kind of like a newer thing, right? ISIL was simply a reformation of the group, as I mentioned before, after a 2007 U.S. military surge. But it can be tracked back even further. And this might be a name that some of you remember, Abu Mahab al-Zarqawi. If you remember when the Bush administration had the ridiculous like pictures and stuff of "we got our guy," and the Obama administration did some of that too. He was one of these people who they got. He was a Jordanian whose group began leading attacks in Iraq around 2003. And I mean, it was because the U.S. invaded the region. And then in 2004, al-Zarqawi's group joined the Al-Qaeda network and you know, gained resources that way, becoming Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So really, Al-Qaeda in Iraq could be linked to the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the removal of Saddam Hussein. But anyway, ISIL was an older organization, and it reformed and one of the various sectarian militias, for that matter, that engaged in regional civil war throughout the 2000s. Because after the early invasion, 2001, 2, 3, 4, when you get to 2005 through 2008 and 9, Iraq was essentially in a state of civil war. It was in a power vacuum. The strong man had been removed, and there wasn't anything really to take its place, and it broke down into just sectarian violence. Some of the more powerful militias joined together, and this is where we have PMF. So PMF, again, was officially recognized by the government of Iraq. So it's not just, you know, Iranian proxies or something like that. There's always been tension between the security forces of Iraq and PMF. PMF has maintained autonomy. So it's never been under complete control of Iraqi military forces. However, it's still under, I guess, an umbrella, you could say, of like the prime minister of Iraq. So it is recognized as an official group. It's not just a bunch of gangs or terrorist cells running around. Some of the more powerful militias in the umbrella organization that comprised the PMF did have links to Iran, but again, it really did come down to sectarianism. Pulling back further, we say, I mentioned Iran was Shia. Iraq is mixed, and it depends geographically where you're at. If you're closer to Iran, it's majority Shia. If you're closer to the Saudi side, Saudi Arabia itself is a Sunni majority country. And really, the two big power brokers in this region now are Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it seems like the United States is choosing to side with Saudi Arabia. And for us, it might be for economic reasons, might be for resources, it might be political, but in the region, again, you can't separate religion from this. And so, yes, it's a nation state. However, it's a theocracy as well, with, a combination of different things, just like Iran is. But it's very much seen as Sunni and Shia as well, not equal to Saudi Arabia and Iran. So, okay. Why does this affect the U.S.? What's all this have to do with what happened? Well, attention of many PMF militia groups, as well as Iraqi protesters, shifted to the U.S. after ISIL's defeat. The U.S. Was then seen as the occupying force, as ISIL essentially once was. And going back further, I made analogies in the previous pod, and of course, every situation is different, but there is a history of colonialism in the region too. And, just thinking about Vietnam as it shifted from France to Japan, to France again, then to the United States, while we thought we were in a war about communism and the North Vietnamese saw this as a war of independence against colonialism. Or more recently and more directly tied, Afghanistan. And of course, we had British colonialism in Afghanistan. And then later, the Soviet Union attempted to invade. There was civil war. And then, of course, the U.S. And so I don't think that can be taken out of this either. The discussion can't just be that there is a terrorist organization that's a proxy of Iran killing Americans, right? Especially when those people were engaged in fighting ISIL and have worked directly with the Iraqi military. And also are framing this discussion from within a colonial mindset, right? And it's also just interesting too that al-Zarqawi's group turned into al-Qaeda in Iraq because, just going to Afghanistan, and I won't go in depth here, but I mean, in recent history, of course, you have British colonialism, but the U.S. of course funded the Muajin forces in Afghanistan, which just means kind of like guerrilla war in Islam. And that's also how Guardians of Blood Brigade are framing their attacks as well as like a Muajin against U.S. occupation. And so the Muajin movement in Afghanistan was against the Soviet Union, which the U.S. backed, of course. And that led to civil war, the Northern Alliance, and the Taliban, and then, of course, the rise of Osama bin Laden from that movement, too. And, I mean, isn't it just, I guess, ironic, maybe that's not the correct word, that bin Laden's group that, kind of formed in next to and with protection of the Taliban out of the Muajin in Afghanistan ended up being in Iraq and supporting an Iraqi version of it after the U.S. had invaded, essentially the U.S. being the Soviet version for the Iraqis at this point. But to kind of draw that abstract discussion back in closer, there's really two events that are more specific to what happened in February and yesterday. The U.S. Deeming in the PMF, or the U.S. deeming a leader in the PMF as a human rights violator, and also the Trump administration's assassination of General Soleimani. So to the first point, the U.S. State Department designated Khalil al-Fayyadi I probably butchered that, but the chairman of Iraq's PMF as a human rights abuser for involvement in protests that occurred in Iraq in 2019. And these protests did happen, and the government retaliation and PMF, as a branch of the Iraqi government, did indeed crush these protests. People were killed and live ammunition was used against them. However, there's more to the story than that. The protests were happening because the Iraqi government was seen as being corrupt. The economy was still poor, unemployment was still high, the U.S. was still in occupying the country. There were beliefs that the government had allegiances to foreign countries, including the U.S. and also Iran. And so in this way, it's almost like a puppet regime. And, you know, think about the whole history of this region and a history of puppet regimes. You know, that's how we have the current government in Iran, of course, was, you know, the revolution in the late 70s, overthrowing the Shah of Iran, who had literally been installed by U.S. and British forces. So, you know, this idea of puppet regimes being beholden to foreign, especially Western countries, is not new. It's part of the culture and the history of the region as well. Protesters attempted to enter the Green Zone, and the Green Zone in Iraq is where the government offices are located. And it was at that point when protesters attempted to enter this area that they were being shot. The Atlantic Council published a poll, this was in 2019 as well, that found only 22% of Iraqis had a favorable view of the U.S. In 2019, a U.S. embassy was attacked. One of the people that was engaged in this attack, Abu Mahid and Mahamis, had been engaged in these types of activities since 1983, I found. So he stemming that far back, had been, you know, attacking and protesting against U.S. occupation in the region. In 1983, it was going on in Kuwait. In early 2020, so moving out of 2019, the Iraqi parliament voted to expel all U.S. troops from the country. It seems that the Trump administration's assassination of General Soleimani helped spark this action. So these are three important things that are more current. These ongoing protests in the region, the U.S. labeling PMF leadership as human rights abusers in reaction to these protests, and remembering PMF is officially part of the Iraqi government, however it maintains autonomy as well. Also remembering that they exist because they helped defeat ISIS or ISIL. So there's that, along with the assassination of General Soleimani. These things led to ongoing protests, and these ongoing protests led to a U.S. embassy attack, and also led to the Iraqi parliament voting to expel U.S. troops. The response from Washington was as follows, and it's a short quote. America is a force for good in the Middle East. And this is from State Department, Morgan Ortegas. And they claimed in the statement that it was reaffirming that the U.S. is going to stay in Iraq, ignoring the parliament vote. So 2020, the parliament listens to the protesters and they tell the U.S., you know, we want you to leave. The prime minister of Iraq told the U.S., you need to start considering how you're going to leave. You need to start making plans. And the State Department basically responded by saying, no, we're not going to. In January 2021, near the anniversary of the Trump administration's assassination of General Soleimani, Iraqi protests flared again, demanding that the U.S. leave Iraq. Elections were postponed by the Iraqi government, which only increased tensions. So that's earlier this year. Protests continued. And there were continuous attacks as well, unrest, throughout January and February of 2021, including a protest at a Turkish embassy in Baghdad, in which protesters were calling for Turkey to end military intervention in northern Iraq. So it's not just concerns about ties to Iran. It's not just the U.S. It's really at this point, anybody who's occupying Iraq, Iraqi people are saying, we want you out, essentially. And it was amidst all of this activity that an air base in the Kurdish region of Iraq was attacked. And that was the event that led to a civilian contractor's death and prompted Biden's retaliation. So I hope, just stopping here, I hope that background and that lead up shows you how this attack on this airbase that ended up killing an American contractor was, in the bigger picture, a very small event that was actually part of much, much bigger things that are happening. And it's not so simple as to say that the people who did it are just a proxy of Iran, that, and we need to retaliate. This is, it's anti-colonialist, protests that are happening. The parliament had asked the U.S. to leave. This group, whatever they want to be called, and whether they call themselves that in a year from now or not, but this militia that exists was part of the PMF, which was a larger movement to expel ISIS. And then even the further back history and backdrops of how Al-Qaeda in Iraq, even why they were even there, listening to the warnings of Saddam Hussein and our colonial history, I hope it just puts things in perspective on just how wrong it is for us to say that, this is like retaliation or something, and that we're going to stand up for ourselves, like we're a victim somehow. Now, this isn't to say that all the players are good guys either. And it's not to say that these people in this militia are good people as well. But, I think that this is something that happens in politics that you don't have when you actually look at this in history and political science. And, this whole thing of like, we're the good guys and they're the bad guys, or even that there are good guys and bad guys, needs to get dropped, right? You can make an argument that the U.S. is equally as much of a bad guy. But why? Because, it doesn't matter. Those are just narratives and opinions. The reality is what was just described. And so the reality is very complex, but part of that reality does involve, sectarianism. But again, part of that reality involves people in that region wanting the U.S. out. Most recently, on March 3rd, several rockets hit another airbase on al-Assad, housing U.S. troops. And unfortunately, this will probably be used as justification by the Biden administration for further intervention. I'm sure it's going to be Iran, Iran, Iran. And I'm sure that Republicans will probably say whatever Biden does, short of dropping a nuclear bomb on the country, that he's being weak. And this is what's scary. And this is, I mentioned this in the previous podcast, but there's no, the frightening part is that there's no anti-war leadership at the moment. There's nobody who's saying, we've done this for 20, 21 years. And for as much as anybody wants to say, we need to retaliate, or we can't abandon our allies, or we can't do this and we can't do that, we also can't be an occupying force for two decades, right? That's not, that should not be a reasonable option to a reasonable person. I'm sorry. So what's disheartening is seeing, especially younger Democrats buying this, right? Not understanding the context or history or why things are happening or what the people in the region even want, right? And as I said in the other pod, Republicans are off the rails. Whatever. They're too busy talking about QAnon and Pizzagate and all their crazy BS. The only people in leadership that we can look to make adult decisions are Democrats. And unfortunately, it seems like Democrats are perfectly fine defending and being an imperialist force, because they're still looking at this juvenile view of like good and bad in the world. So we can see the Biden administration framing is just very inadequate. It ignores all context, all recent history of events. It's seriously disheartening again to see Democrats, especially young Democrats, supporting this forever war, truly Orwellian forever war, by continuously moving goalposts. And honestly, you know, can anyone even clearly articulate what the goal is for the U.S. in the region? I mean, you know, without, I'm not going to go through it, but there have been many benchmarks. And as those benchmarks move or pass or opposition is defeated, then new ones come up. And so I would challenge anybody who's defending the U.S., you know, keeping our soldiers in this area. What does success look like? And honestly, if you can't articulate success, then I think you need to re-examine your position. And there's just a few key takeaways that I want to touch on before wrapping this one up. So there are very, very real events, right? And I think while they could be tracked back to the you know, early days of the invasion and even prior in recent history, I think that what we're really looking at are protests that started in 2019 and the assassination of General Soleimani by the Trump administration. Those seem to be the two big things, right? That the existence of the PMF, you know, having been there in the first place and officially recognized by the Iraqi government to help defeat ISIL. And then the U.S. turning around and saying that the remnants of that group are, you know, just Iranian proxies, just sorely misunderstanding the region and the realities on the ground. Not saying that they aren't in one way or another connected to Iran, but that's not the whole story. So, okay, key takeaways. You know, anytime we talk about this, I think we need to remember that we, speaking from the U.S. perspective, we are the occupiers. We have been there 20 years, right? Iraqi parliament voted for us to leave. Most people, according to polls, in that area don't want us there. So, you know, we need to remember that, and that needs to be the framing. And we can't deny, I mean, you just cannot deny that this is not an occupation at best or imperialism. And you can't deny recent history. You can't deny what happened. Well, I'll get there in a moment. So the second point, the group that we're talking about, whatever you want to call them, and I say that because I think that maybe the name is kind of a front group, but the group that is the group shooting rockets at U.S. contractors, they fought alongside the Iraqi security forces against ISIL, right, against ISIS. Their goal is to end the occupation, period. So, you know, it might have been fighting against the threat of ISIL, but now that is essentially gone, now it's fighting against the occupation of the United States. And, you know, that kind of goes back to what I was going to say a moment ago. We can't ignore recent history. I mean, this is, in so many ways, Afghanistan playing itself out again, and the U.S. Having the role of the Soviet Union, right? To the point in which someone from this group, Guardians of Blood Brigade, used the same term, Muajin, in discussing attacking U.S. military interests, right? And the Muajin is in Afghanistan is where Osama bin Laden came from. It's where the Taliban came from out of civil war in the region after Soviet occupation, and Muajin is essentially how Osama bin Laden, you know, was able to create his organization in Iraq. And that's the term being used by these groups describing attacks on the United States. We have an entire generation that has only known war. And, you know, this is a different topic, but it's connected. And it's something I'd like to talk about separately, but it's part of this. We've been at war for 21 years. And this is the first time ever in the history of the United States that there's ever been a generation like this that has only known war. I talked about the Muajin with Afghanistan, the Soviet Union, and out of that civil war, the rise of the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden with Al-Qaeda, and a Muajin-type civil war in Iraq. There was a civil war in Iraq after U.S. occupation began in the early 2000s. ISIS was the threat, and you know, after ISIS was defeated, all the militia groups that had fallen under this umbrella of PMF are essentially now looking at the U.S. as the occupier, while other people, again, a lot of this falls along Sunni and Shia lines, but many people in Iraq are looking at Iran and the United States and Turkey as occupying forces that they want to leave. And just lastly, and this is the further back point, just the history of colonialism in the region. I mean, yes, Iraq was kind of drawn in the sand, right? We had the world wars, and that's when the empires fell, and you know, maybe here the Ottoman Empire. But the idea of in more recent history, I mean, the late 70s, right? That's how you have the government of Iran now, direct U.S. involvement in 1950s elections. You know, this idea of historical colonialism, you know, we would like to discuss things again, as I said earlier, in a very compartmentalized way. Like, well, we can't allow Iranian proxies to attack contractors, so we need to retaliate. Well, that's a nice, you know, thought, and it isn't that it's 100% untrue, but it's one sentence in a book, and that book, if you go back 100 pages, 200 pages, does include this history of colonialism. And that is tied into the perspective of people in that region, right? It isn't just this current invasion of the US, although it's been 20 years, right? This goes back generations and generations. And it can be a Western imperial view through Western imperialism. It can be viewed through the lens of religion. But regardless of how it's viewed, we need to understand that is how it's being viewed. So I don't have the answer specifically as to the best way to leave the region. Saddam Hussein basically told us we were going to break something that we couldn't fix. And, you know, all the stuff we said about Saddam Hussein being a dictator and being horrible was true. But that's what he did to keep this region in check, to be honest. And I don't know, aside from just endless war, right? For generations, I don't know what goal the U.S. military would have in staying there, except maybe to try to prevent Shia and Sunni infighting. But that's really what's going to happen. It's you're going to have sectarian violence, and you're going to have Saudi Arabia and Iran try to influence this, and to a much lesser degree, Syria. And I guess the US, I guess Democrats, you know, I guess 20-year-olds on Twitter are saying they're okay with the United States just being there forever to help put off this, I guess, you know, somewhat inevitable event. The only way that it could be maybe resolved in a somewhat good way would be if ultimately it gets resolved politically. And all this is too new for that. But those are the hopes. And I do hope that with this knowledge, just the next time, because I haven't seen yet what the Biden administration is going to say, but I hope that this helps, you know, take the lens of which media in the United States, and especially politicians, try to show the reality of what's happening. I hope it expands that. I hope it takes the whole lens off the damn camera and helps you see the reality of what's going on.